My name is Lola, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network. Yay, I said booyah.
This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and today's podcast promotion features two Facebook fan pages. The first is Firefighters United, South Carolina chapter. This page is for firefighters by firefighters. It's a place where you can find news, humor, pictures, and artwork. The second podcast promotion features 911 dispatchers breaking the silence. With over 10,000 fans and counting, this is a place for dispatchers and others who are the unseen that suffer from PTSD or other stress-related job issues. It's a place to vent and cut loose, and if you are easily offended by curse words or others, make sure to read the disclaimer in their about section. And now for the show. Good afternoon. This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is going to be episode 46 of the Within the Trenches podcast. Now, usually Whitney's here with me, and we do these awesome shows, but she is still under the weather, and she will probably be back next time. So get well, Whitney. For everybody who's been, I guess, on the east side of the state, mostly except for the punks in Florida who haven't dealt with this at all. Up here in Michigan, we've been dealing with a snowpocalypse 2014. This has been been good times. There's been snow just covering everywhere. You can't go anywhere and do anything. Actually, looking out the window right now, the sun is trying to fight through the weather to peek out a little bit. But some of the things that have been going on, you know, one of the fire departments, Ganges Fire, that's part of the county that I used to work for in 911 dispatch, they were going out to a fire call and they had to call on some plows to go out there and plow a path just so that they could get through and do what they had to do. So that's what we've been dealing with over here. So, you know, stay warm and, you know, hopefully this weekend, like they've been saying, it's supposed to get a lot warmer. But, I'm excited about this new episode because it's something that, you know, really has, it's just starting to come out, really. It's starting to come out in the news and people are becoming more aware of it. And it has to do with, you know, a lot of the stress within 911. And sure, all of us, you know, listening, you're thinking, of course there's stress on 911. We're taking these life and death calls. But there's a lot of people who don't really maybe pay attention to it. And one of the stories I want to tell really quick before I introduce my guest today, it's one of the last calls that I took in dispatch. I believe it was maybe the last week that I was in dispatch, actually. And what had happened was I took this call from this girl, and she was hysterical. She had said that this guy had come in, that he was very upset, and he was just yelling at her and her mother. And they were trying to get him to leave. And I was trying to ask her exactly what he was saying. And, you know, it finally just came out that he was upset and that he was going to go ahead and kill himself. And so I'm trying to get all this information from her as fast as I can. It's very, very busy in there. There was four of us working, but the phones were just ringing off the hook. And I'm getting all this information from her. And I ask her what kind of car this guy is in. And she says that he had just left in a blue Mazda. And so I also asked if she had a phone number for this guy so that I could try to call him, you know, maybe try to, you know, start talking to him, because I've done it before. I've taken suicidal calls where I've been able to talk to people and talk them out of doing it. So that was one of the things I wanted to do. So I get off the phone with her and I start to call this guy. So I call him. And it starts to ring. And as soon as it starts to ring, another call comes into 911. Now, I was looking around the room to see if anybody was able to get it, but we were completely tied up and I had to hang up. Nobody was answering the phone, so I hung up to answer this other call. I pick up the phone and there's a gentleman saying that he had just witnessed a very bad car accident. There's a vehicle that it was speeding and went head on into a tree. And we've got people heading over there, and I asked the gentleman, the caller, what kind of car it was. And I had this feeling, I just knew something was wrong with this call. And I was thinking, what if it was this person? I looked at the map on the screen, and the location where this was just down the road from the original location from the suicidal call that I had taken. And I just had a feeling that that was the guy. So as the guy got closer to the car, he said it was a blue Mazda. And I yelled over to my partner and I said, you need to let the officers know that this is possibly going to be my suicidal subject. And sure enough, it was that guy from the previous call. And for whatever reason, I mean, even right now, just talking about the call, I've got goosebumps. And whenever I see a blue Mazda, I think of this call. You know, I was so obsessed with this call after the fact, I started looking at the map and mapping out the directions that he could have taken, the amount of time that I took on the phone call with this person. You know, what if I would have asked, you know, this question instead of this question and immediately called him? What if I would have gotten through? There was all these what ifs going through my head, but I guess it was just inevitable this was going to happen. But you know, it's that kind of stress that sticks with you. You know, it's the little things that you end up seeing that trigger these calls. You know, they keep coming back. And so segueing from this story, my guest today is Michelle, and she's an assistant professor at Northern Illinois University, and she's been doing research for the past few years on different mental and physical stress for 911 dispatchers. How's it going, Michelle?
It's going great.
Excellent. Glad to have you on the show. And just from what you heard on the story that I was telling, I'm trying to think of how to ask. I mean, what can you see, or some of from the research that you've been doing, how this has stuck with me? Like the fact that whenever I see a blue Mazda, it takes me back. I go back to that call.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this, you know, first of all, every telecommunicator I've ever taught, I don't have a history in 911 telecommunication, just to put that out there up front. But every telecommunicator I've ever talked to, or every telecommunicator that we enroll in our research, has that one call, right? Mm-hmm. They've handled many, many calls, and sometimes they have more than one of them. But that one call that was just particularly upsetting for whatever reason, maybe because the caller ended up, the caller died. Maybe the person was hysterical and they felt like they could have done something and couldn't or didn't. Right. Or, you know, maybe the kind of the details of it are particularly gruesome or horrifying, or maybe it's a child. And so, you know, we do know that, you know, and this isn't a surprise to anyone in the field, but most telecommunicators have that one worst call. Now, what happens during, you know, to our body during these calls is that, you know, our blood pressure goes through the roof. We have a very strong kind of fight or flight response. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that having that really high level of physiological reactivity mixed with all of these kind of cognitive thoughts about what you did or didn't do can affect you long term. One of the ways that it can affect you long term is through post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that you're talking about are what we would consider symptoms of that disorder. So one of the most predominant ones is re-experiencing symptoms. So, you know, kind of feeling like you're back in that moment, or seeing a blue Mazda and getting upset. Shifts in your kind of thinking and your cognitions about, you know, the world, and, you know, if you're to blame, if you're, you know, holding a lot of kind of guilt is another kind of symptom that we sometimes see. Some of the other things that we sometimes see is, you know, being upset just thinking about it. So maybe not necessarily seeing a blue Mazda, but sitting there during the day and just all of a sudden kind of the details of the event pop into your mind, whether or not that's, you know, kind of thinking about the car, thinking about the voice of the caller, or thinking about some of the details. Those are all things that, you know, kind of long term, if you continue to experience, fall into that PTSD diagnosis. And my recent research is actually showing that in the follow-up study that I'm doing right now, we have almost 500 experienced telecommunicators who have participated, and we're finding that almost a quarter of them are reporting PTSD scores that are consistent with the diagnosis of PTSD. So,
wow.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
Yes. Yes.
Well, so. That's alarming.
Yes, it is alarming. Now, that being said, 75% do not, despite always having a worse call. So, you know, most people are actually, you know, the majority actually are resilient.
Right.
And you can have a couple symptoms of PTSD and still not qualify for that diagnosis. So, you know, if you see a blue Mazda and you're upset, but otherwise you're fine, you're not really impaired, you don't have flashbacks, you know, you don't fall into that category. But people who continue long term to have a lot of different symptoms associated do fall into that category.
Oh, exactly. Now, I know that we just jumped in, but, you know, because I told that story, I wanted to get your reaction on it right away. But to kind of backtrack now, if you can tell me a little bit about yourself, you know, the work that you're doing, and I guess really what made you want to do this research?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am an assistant professor, as you mentioned, at Northern Illinois, and I predominantly study trauma across the board. So I'm really trained in studying and treating. I'm also a licensed clinical psychologist in the state of Illinois, treating post-traumatic stress disorder as well as other, you know, mental health struggles that people have after trauma and, you know, just more generally. So, you know, I'm a trained clinician. I've been doing research on trauma and its negative health consequences since I started graduate school, which would have been in, oh my gosh, this is a while, 2003, so about 10 years. And previously, a lot of my research was looking at assault victims. So, you know, women who had been in violent relationships, sexual assault survivors, people who were really suffering at the hand because they had been traumatized at the hands of another person. So, which confers a whole lot of risk for adverse mental health and for reasons we won't even get into. I had also done, when I was in graduate school, some work with retired police officers.
Okay.
I had worked on a project with Dr. Namdi Pol, who's now at Smith, and really looking at what are maybe some of the long-term physiological kind of effects of having worked in police work, assessing for PTSD, that type of thing. And so I had some previous experience collecting data and doing research with retired police officers. And so I got my position now. I started at NIU in 2009. And one of the research assistants who was working in my lab, who was an undergrad, one day we were talking about police officers, and I was like kind of talking, I was being kind of glib about police officers. And being like, yeah, they're so funny because they're so stoic. And, you know, I was talking about this research that we had done where we would ask them to tell us how upset they were, and they would say, oh, I'm not upset at all, but their physiological reactivity would be like going through the roof.
Right.
And I was like kind of, you know, we're talking about this. And she said, well, my husband's a police officer. And I'm thinking, oh, I really hope I didn't just offend her. But But anyway, and she didn't really say anything else about it. But we kind of talked about police culture and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she came back to me a couple of days later and said, you know, I used to work as a 911 dispatcher. And I said, oh, you didn't mention that. And I didn't know that. And she said, yeah. She's like, and, you know, do you know that there's not a single research study on telecommunicators except for a couple dissertations? And I was shocked because I just assumed that, like the mounting evidence that we have for police officers, firefighters, emergency room nurses, that there would also be at least some line of research with 911 telecommunicators.
Right.
And so we sat down and she started telling me more about what this job entailed. And I think as she talked, my jaw just kept progressively dropping closer to the floor because I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this job sounds really hard and challenging. And, you know, there's a whole lot of aspects about it that really make it kind of ripe for having some of these kind of adverse psychological reactions. So, you know, so we just started talking about doing like a pilot project. We did a kind of shorter pilot project. We had 170 telecommunicators from across the country take part in that initial project. It took quite a while. It took almost a year to collect that data.
Okay.
And then we started kind of analyzing it and writing it up, and it generated a lot of interest, a lot more than I probably ever realized that it would. I think mostly because telecommunicators have been so ignored for so long, and the effects that telecommunication can have on your mental health has been just denied. And so I think showing that it can have real mental health effects was something that people really valued about the research. And so so then I was in deep. So so now it's just led to a whole bunch of kind of follow-up projects. I'm also expanding into looking at the physical health functioning of telecommunicators. Mm-hmm. And then I'm writing a grant right now to the National Institute of Health that would fund some research projects moving forward with telecommunicators. So,
man, very busy.
Yeah, very busy.
Yeah, I can see where, you know, you would get a huge response from it because, you know, you're right. We have been kind of pushed aside for some reason. And I don't know why that is. You know, there's a lot of people that I've talked to throughout, you know, my co-host and I throughout this whole show where, you know, there's been other things where we've talked to like people that are with, you know, in schism, and they have said that, you know, whenever there's something going on, they don't have people talking to the dispatchers. You know, they always have it for fire, EMS and police, but dispatch is pushed aside. So
yeah,
it's good that we're finally getting, you know, some that is finally getting out there, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. You know, that something is doing something. And you know, from the fans, when I posted some questions on there, they wanted me to thank you for doing the research that you're doing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I have to say that it's probably the most rewarding research that I've done. I mean, just the response that we've gotten from people. So I said it took us about a year to get 170 telecommunicators in the first sample. We've been collecting data for 6 months recently, and we have 500. So,
wow.
you know, the outpouring of kind of support and interest has been unbelievable. And it's, you know, it's been really rewarding to me that I feel like the research that I'm doing might actually make a difference in the world. So, yeah, I appreciate people's gratitude.
Yeah, definitely. And looking at, you had given me a webinar that you did back in September.
Yeah.
And, there was something that really, and it was something I posted actually just a little excerpt of this one portion, the previous research. I think it's like the sixth slide. It's right in the beginning. And it's talking about how in 1987 that, you know, dispatchers reported, you know, showing high levels of stress, but not high enough to consider clinical. So from 1987 all the way up to about within the last year or so,
yeah.
I don't know, I guess what's really your thought, or what did you find out from other people as to why it has changed? I had posted the same thing on the fan page as to how it changed. Has it changed since 1987, or has it really stayed the same? You know, what was your thought?
You know, I think it's interesting. I mean, so just to kind of comment on that research, I mean, it was done, it had a very small sample size. I think there were only like 30 or 35 telecommunicators total in that sample.
Okay.
And so you can imagine that depending on where they collected data, say they collected in predominantly a couple call centers, where in general the work culture in those centers is very good, or there's a lot of support, or, you know, they have good, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It could be that it shows, oh, it's not, you know, it's not that, it's stressful, but it's not that bad. Because it was just a sample bias. So it was just kind of a biased sample from the beginning. It's very small. You know, it could just be skewed just, you know, naturally. So there is that possibility that it was just not a great sample in the first place, which is why we collect nice, big, huge samples. So there's a lot of diversity in, you know, responses. But I do also think, you know, kind of thinking about, and again, I don't have a background as a telecommunicator, but from what I know and from what I've seen, and I've been in lots of call centers now and I've talked to lots of telecommunicators, is that, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that telecommunicators have to deal with that I think people just aren't aware. Like, you know, there's all the protocols and the standards and just the fact that, you know, the Freedom of Information Act, your call could be pulled at any one time and people could have access to it, adds a whole nother level of stress.
Oh yeah.
I think we live in a just very different culture than we did in, you know, the late 80s. There's a whole lot more kind of, I think, threats out there.
Yeah.
You know, so I just, you know, we live in a different culture, and I, you know, again, I was not a telecommunicator in the 80s, so I don't really know what it was like, but I am recurrently shocked, and I guess I shouldn't be shocked anymore, but I always am, at kind of the level of kind of rigidity, or I guess I don't know what the word is, but I'm kind of always so surprised at how under the microscope telecommunicators seem to be when I go to call centers and when I talk to them. And like I said, you have kind of all these protocols and standards if you do something wrong, and, you know, getting written up, and you know, and now on the forefront of, you know, maybe NG-911, there are constant, you know, technological changes, changes in equipment. I mean, all of this stuff can really add a lot of stress, which in and of itself could just be stress. But when you're adding it on to recurrent exposure to potentially traumatizing calls, where you have a caller who is suicidal or homicidal or dies, or you have a child that was injured, or you have et cetera, really kind of tips the balance to the other side.
Yeah, I can see exactly what you mean there, because when I was in dispatch, I know that, well, I was a supervisor there, and so what would happen is every month we would get tapes of phone calls. We would have to choose phone calls from the people on our team, and we would have to pick one emergency call and one non-emergency call. And the majority of the time, the emergency calls were almost always domestic calls. So whenever we were working and there was a domestic call, it wouldn't fail that at least 2 to 3 times out of the shift, when someone was done with the domestic call, they would hang up and say, "I hope that does not get QA'd, the quality assurance." And yeah, I would jokingly say, "Well, that's the one I'm going to pull. So thank you very much for that one." And so I'm sure, even though we were joking, that really does add to the stress on there, because I know it would happen to me whenever my supervisor would tell me, or even when I was a supervisor, because we had quality assurance as well. So it would be the assistant director who would choose a call for us, and then our other supervisors would critique us on the call. So,
I understand the theory behind it, and it's good practice, et cetera, but I mean, that just sounds horrifying to me.
It is horrifying, especially because, you know, we've got a list of things that we would have to ask. And one of the main things, it was, I believe, maybe worth 25 to 50 points, but it was cross streets. You have to get crossroads. So if you missed it, or if you're going through the questions and you're trying to listen to everything that they're saying and the set of questions that you have to ask, your mind is just getting scrambled.
I bet. Yeah. It's just, it's an interesting thing, you know, and I kind of think of, you know, before I kind of got into this, I kind of thought, oh, it's just so standard. It's probably so standardized. And it is pretty standardized, like how you respond to callers, and although that differs across agencies and whatnot, but but you're still human, and you're still dealing with a highly distressed caller who's human. And so just kind of the level of kind of error from the protocol makes a lot of sense to me, that would happen, and yet you could be scrutinized for it at any one time, which to me is just it doesn't have good implications for mental health.
Yeah, definitely, because like you said, you observed and noticed that we're under a microscope, and we are, you know, we don't usually get a pat on the back, and there wasn't a time where I always wanted a pat on the back or anything like that, but as soon as something went wrong, it was dispatch's fault. If you look in the news, you don't always see the good things that are happening with dispatch. You see when something goes wrong. So then you hear your own voice or a friend's voice on the call that was, you know, allegedly messed up or whatever. And that just builds onto the stress, and you just start knocking people down.
Absolutely.
That really, really sucks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's just, like I said, just kind of the level of anxiety and self-blame and self-scrutiny and just kind of emotional numbing that can come with having to deal with that day in and out, plus the fact that you're, again, dealing with highly disturbing calls. It is an occupation that I think in some ways is quite ripe for suffering, especially when there's not a whole lot of kind of acknowledgement of the ways in which people can be suffering and a lot of kind of standardized protocols for prevention and care.
And since we're on this topic here, in your research, you found that there are some types of calls that are associated with more with distress than others. What were those?
Yeah, so calls in which a child, I think the child calls were, you know, among the most commonly mentioned. So calls in which a child has been injured or has been killed. Was notable. And you know, it's kind of interesting because I have children and, you know, I started doing this research before I had children and then I had children like in the context of collecting the initial pilot data and the number of people who said a child drowning in a pool was their worst call was notable. I mean, I think it came up 4 or 5 times, which probably doesn't seem like that much out of 170, but how many people actually handle a call where a child's been drowned in a pool? Like the odds of 5 people identifying that is actually not that high. So, so calls involving children, calls involving, police officers or other emergency responders, in which those call, which other emergency responders have been injured, or killed, or shot, calls that involve family or friends, and then also calls, you know, kind of an accidental death of an adult. So, so those were the calls that tended to be associated with kind of, or were more commonly identified as kind of the worst event, and the ones that tended to confer higher risk for things like PTSD.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, and you know, everybody who's listening to this, I'm sure we can all agree that you know, the calls that you mentioned are definitely those calls, because I mean, I've taken all those types of calls and those were the worst ones that you know, just happened to stick with me. And I would come home and my 9-year-old, well, I guess at the time he would have been 7 or 8 because I'm out of dispatch now, but you know, he would ask, "How was work? What kind of calls did you take?" I'm not going to tell you what kind of calls I took, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know how anybody could continue to work in the field after having children, because there's something, or maybe I'm just kind of weird about this, but you know, once you have children, the risk of having to handle calls where children are, there's just other awful, malicious things are happening is just, it's just hard. So,
yeah, it is hard, and especially when you're taking when you take a call, like let's say a domestic situation, and there's, you know, the husband and wife, and then they've got a child, and you hear the kid in the background, and you're talking to who is the cause of it. It's kind of hard. I know it was hard for me to kind of hold my tongue. You know, I never said anything that would get me in trouble, but you know, I'm trying to tell him or her to stay separated from the other people or go to a different room, and they're yelling and swearing at me, and I can feel myself, you know, I can feel my blood pressure just going up and, you know, wanting to say something, and then finally getting off the phone and just sitting there and thinking, you know, this, why?
Well, why? And, you know, honestly, I think one of the other things is that, you know, a lot of telecommunicators don't know how a call ends. Where other emergency responders, firefighters, police officers often do know how a call ends, for better or worse. I mean, it might be that the person dies, but at least you have some closure. And what we know about our brains is that our brain will continue to try to process something until that processing of that event is complete. Well, if you don't have the end of the story, it actually increases your risk for adverse mental health, in a way that is somewhat more unique to 911 than some of the other emergency responding occupations.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, you're standing by a person and they kind of chuckle and you say, "What?" And they say, "Oh, nothing." Well, it starts eating at you because you want to know, you know, and you, that's the a light, funny version of it. But, you know, you're definitely right. You know, we don't get that, that closure. And that was one of the reasons in the beginning that I wanted to start doing this, because I wanted people, especially the general public who listens to the show, to know we don't get that closure. And this is what we actually deal with. So when you're talking to us and you want to know why we put you on hold, this is why, because you're calling to get fireworks times on 911 and I was just giving CPR to somebody, but yeah. I had to put them on hold to have them continue doing CPR and put them on hold to get another call because somebody could have just gotten stabbed. But people right. don't understand that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and I just think, you know, just the unknown, like if you're an officer or a firefighter and you're mm-hmm. dispatched, you are going oftentimes with quite a bit of details where, you know, telecommunications, you know, the phone rings, you have no idea what's going to come through on the other line. And right. so, and that's another actual thing that we know from the cognitive psychology field, that when we aren't sure what to predict out of something, our mind processes things in a very, very different way. Again, uh-huh. in a way that might make one more at risk for kind of adverse kind of memories and trauma down the road. So there's a lot of things about working in 911 that, like I said, kind of make it conducive to struggling long term.
Now, what can account for, you know, why symptoms of depression and PTSD develop?
Oh, geez.
Besides just the stressful calls. You know, I'm kind of trying yeah. to pick that out of your webinar that you had there.
Yeah. Do you think you could be a little bit more specific with your question? Like what are the things that most predict PTSD?
Yeah, I like that.
Okay. So there's a lot of things that, you know, kind of... can kind of enhance risk for developing PTSD. Some of those things are, you know, before you're ever exposed to trauma, there are some things about kind of people that make them more at risk. So we know, for example, that people who are younger and exposed to trauma at an earlier age are more at risk for PTSD. We know that generally kind of lack less education, mm-hmm. personality factors, like people who tend to be very what we call neurotic, so they have a lot of, they just tend to be somebody that has a lot of negative emotions. Those people are all individuals who tend to be at higher risk for PTSD. Then there's a whole lot of kind of what we call peritraumatic factors. And some of those factors are things like how much distress you actually felt in the moment of the trauma. So, and it's something that we actually assessed in our previous studies and then our ongoing studies. So people who in the moment of the trauma or like the potentially traumatic call experience feeling horrified, experience feeling, you know, helpless, feel like they can't do anything, mm-hmm. Feel like they might lose control, feel like they might pass out. That is suggestive of a very, very strong physiological response that's happening in the moment that we know places one more at risk down the road for PTSD. So people who tend to experience a lot of negative affect and emotions at the moment of a trauma are much more at risk long term, as well as people who what we call peritraumatic dissociation. So people who in the moment actually are, for example, able to handle the call and they're doing things, but they feel like they're outside of themselves. They feel like they're watching themselves from afar, don't remember parts of the call afterwards. Those also are people who are more at risk. And the kind of theory behind that is that your body is so overwhelmed at the moment that it's your mind's way of kind of saving you, right? So instead of having to deal with a strong negative affect in the moment, your brain kind of partitions off and lets you kind of allow yourself to kind of watch you from the outside. Sounds kind of funky, but anyway, so that distress, that dissociation, those things are much more strongly associated with PTSD mm-hmm. in the long run. As well as, you know, if somebody, and again, this doesn't apply too much for 911 telecommunicators, but feeling like you're going to die or being physically injured also confers higher risk. So again, most 911 telecommunicators probably don't feel like their own life is in jeopardy or that, you know, they're going to be injured during an event. But being witness or being exposed to other people who are severely injured or think that they're going to die also enhance risk for PTSD. So, you know, these things run so counter to what our cognitions are about the world, right? You know, in general, in, raised in just kind of adequate environments, you know, we tend to be optimistic people. We tend to think that the world is safe and that there was meaningful cause and effect, and things happen for a reason, and bad guys get what they deserve, and good people, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, having to confront some sort of event that runs so strongly counter to those schemas that most people have about the world can be very, very traumatizing and lead to kind of a shattering of those cognitions.
Yeah, I think working in dispatch actually made me a little more paranoid, though.
Yeah.
Because I know that, you know, I can't even think of the situation right now, but I know that there's been times where my kid would go outside to go play or something, and I would stand by the window, and my wife would say, "He's fine out there." I'm like, "I know, but you don't know who that person is who's walking by down the road."
I mean, I think I've become more paranoid since doing this research, honestly. And I'm not even doing the calls, but I feel like I've become more paranoid.
Yeah. One of us.
Yeah. But like reading through all the stories that I've read through, it's just kind of like, yeah, this, you know, it definitely challenges kind of our fundamental assumptions about how the world can and does work. So,
right.
Which again also makes it harder to can kind of maintain PTSD symptomatology or cause it. So,
Now in your research and all with, let's say, burnout,
yes.
Was there a certain amount of percentage of, or how do I put this? The amount of dispatchers like going into their years of service, mm-hmm. You know, I think there was something that said that you guys are dealing with people who were within 11 years and higher. Working in dispatch, or was there people earlier than that? I just want to know, like, because I thought I heard once from someone that once you hit that 7 years or 8 years, yeah. Or you got that itch, you're pretty much burned out. You know, yeah. A lot of people.
It's like marriage, right? That's
yeah.
So. We had in the pilot study, we had people, the average was 12 years, but we had people all the way from 1 or 2 years all the way up to, you know, 25-year experience. And then our current experience survey that we're doing, we have people all the way from, you know, several months all the way up to 25, 30 years. So we have a broad range. Now, it's really interesting because we have not been able to really find anything connected with years of service. So, or at least nothing linear. So it's not as though, you know, the longer people stay, the more at risk they are for PTSD, or the longer they stay, the more depression, or, you know, the longer they stay, the less risk they are to drink, you know, like that kind of stuff. And it's probably because there are those, what we call, you know, bi or trimodal distributions where, you know, people are really burnt out at like a year of leave, or they burn out and leave at like 7 years and then maybe like 15 and then 25, you know, like, so we haven't really been able to make much sense out of that data as of right now. And probably because there are these kind of humps in, you know, burnout and job attrition and job satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me like people, if they stay 6 or 7 years, then they start moving into management. And then they're not on the front lines. They generally seem happier once they've kind of gotten to that point. And it might be that people who, I don't know, maybe don't think they'll go into management or are burnt out, they just leave. So I don't know. We haven't really been able to make, like I said, a whole lot of sense out of that data so far.
So I guess, have you found anything in your research that might be able to help prevent burnout or PTSD in any way?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So not specifically in my research. So, you know, the preliminary research that we're doing is really just to kind of survey the extent of the problem. So, so, you know, what are the rates of PTSD, depression, stress? You know, what is the level of physical health problems? What, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
The research hasn't gotten to the point yet where we're actually looking at, you know, what are some prevention efforts that could be effective? What are some things, some intervention efforts that could be effective? Now, as a clinical psychologist, having worked with people, there's a whole bunch of things that you can do to help. But we haven't looked at that from an empirical perspective yet. In terms of, you know, putting my kind of clinical psychologist hat on, you know, there's a couple, you know, if I mean, I could go into probably 100 things, but probably the main ones to really, that most people can do is talk to people. So what I've noticed in you know, some of the call centers I've gone in is that people aren't talking a whole lot. Or you get off a hard call and you might say, "Oh, that was awful," or, you know, "Oh, I hope you don't QA that one."
Right.
but actually kind of talking about the calls and what may have been upsetting can be helpful. Now, that being said, going on and on and what we saw ruminating about them and replaying them and talking about them over and over again so that you're feeling those same emotions again does not tend to be very helpful.
Right.
But just kind of seeking out support from your colleagues, from your peers, can be very, very helpful. We're also, I'm collaborating with Dr. Hendrika Mishka out at University of Washington, and we're debating, or we're kind of pulling together this grant at one point that will look at kind of mindfulness-based interventions for telecommunicators.
Okay.
What that involves is just learning to have increased mindfulness of one's feelings in the moment. It also incorporates things like very brief kind of meditations, what we call mindful walking, mindful eating, which a lot of people, when they hear it, they think it just sounds kind of like new agey and goofy. But there's a lot of empirical support for mindfulness-based intervention approaches to just help people be more aware of how they're feeling in the moment, and then being able to let go of negative feelings without judgment. So there's a lot of support in the field for these approaches. And again, we're hoping to write a grant so that we can actually study this and whether or not these types of interventions could be effective with 911 telecommunicators. Just getting up, standing up, walking around, it can all be very helpful. And yeah, like I said, there's a lot of things you can do. I don't think we really have time to go into all of them.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I think that those are kind of the big heavy hitters that I think really can make a difference.
Yeah, communication is huge. And there's always, everyone has always said it. I know I've said it a few times jokingly. And even though I say it jokingly, it's true. Being communicators, we're the worst at communicating.
Yeah.
which I've never heard.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's weird to say, kind of odd, because, you know, the whole job is communications. We talk to everybody. We're on the radios, we're on the phones, we're dealing with those crazy calls. But when it comes to dealing with stress at work or you know, workplace drama or anything like that with our coworkers, we don't talk to each other. We just let it go, and it builds up and builds up until it finally explodes, and then people have time off.
Absolutely. Well, and you become out of practice. I mean, you know, you guys are trained to get specific information, but you know, it doesn't really behoove a telecommunicator to be like a super empathic, emotional, you know,
right
person.
Yeah.
On the job, you're not going to perform very effectively. But over time, you know, it almost gets kind of, you know, numbed or dulled. And then actually talking about how you're feeling can be hard. It's like you're out of practice. So,
yeah, having thick skin sometimes turns into being desensitized, and then we can't communicate. So that kind of sucks. But going into the wrap up of this, there's so much more that we could talk about. I think we might have to have a part two.
We might
to do another episode so we can get through more. What is your main goal with the research, everything that you're doing? What is your main goal, and what do you see yourself doing in the future with it?
Yeah, well, you know, my main goal is to, you know, first of all, I guess, you know, kind of explore the extent of the problem and then start developing intervention and prevention efforts that are empirically supported and that, you know, agencies and organizations can actually use to create a happier and healthier workforce. Because while there are lots of characteristics about the job that I think do make it at high risk for, you know, adverse mental health, that doesn't necessarily mean that mental, you know, adverse mental health has to develop. You know, one of the studies that we found that, you know, 41% of our initial samples had like no symptoms of mental illness, like nothing. No, they reported no depressive symptoms, no PTSD symptoms, very resilient group, right? So in general, you know, it's clear that there are some people who kind of get through this unscathed and resilient and do very well. And so trying to identify what it is about, you know, those folks that tend to make them more resilient, and then being able to kind of train or do preventions that kind of target those things could be very, very effective. So while, you know, a telecommunicator is probably, you know, or is at some point going to have to handle this worst call where something really, truly horrifying that no human probably would ever want to hear about, think about, be exposed to, doesn't necessarily mean that that they will, you know, will develop adverse mental health. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of that could be done in the field to make a happier, healthier workforce. And, you know, this has huge public health implications because it doesn't obviously just affect the 911 telecommunicators, but it, you know, affects every single person who calls 911 at a moment of need, because we know that things like PTSD, depression, alcohol abuse, these have significant impact on our ability to concentrate, our decision making, our focus, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, I definitely thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having
and,
me.
And sharing this information. And like I said, the fans earlier said that they really appreciated you doing this research and getting this out there. And I do as well. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So, well, this is going to be the wrap-up of episode number 46. And I got my phone ringing over here. I'm in my office, so my phone is ringing in here. So, this is going to be the wrap-up of episode number 46. And if you have any comments, questions, or anything, you can email us. It's going to be wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, which is @WTTPodcast. Actually, let me say that again. It's actually going to be @911podcast. I forgot that I switched it over. And you can also find us on Facebook and like us there. It's facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. And this will be posted up and available 24/7 on thejabberlog.com. You just listened to a Code 7 Network podcast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to wttpodcast@gmail.com.